A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
The night of July 13, 2026, a U.S. Navy destroyer somewhere in the Gulf of Oman. Third consecutive night of CENTCOM strikes just wrapped. The flight deck is quiet now. The Combat Information Center is still humming. And somewhere in the mess, a 22-year-old operations specialist is drinking burnt coffee and wondering whether tomorrow brings a fourth night of bombs or another round of diplomatic cables from Washington. That scene is happening right now as we record this, so Daniel sent us this one, and it's a question about what that scene actually feels like from the inside. When the president is tweeting about negotiations one week and ordering strikes the next, what does that look like for the people operating the radars, loading the missiles, standing watch in 110-degree heat? What is this on-and-off tempo actually like for those deployed when the commander-in-chief seems, from the outside at least, impossible to predict?
The question gets at something most coverage completely misses. The public sees two modes, dramatic strike footage or boring diplomatic lulls, but the operational reality is neither of those things. It's a constant, structured choreography that never stops, regardless of whether bombs are falling. And the whiplash between modes, that's actually the defining feature of this deployment, not a bug in the system. Think of it like a hospital emergency department. On a quiet Tuesday afternoon, the staff isn't relaxing. They're restocking carts, reviewing protocols, running drills. The quiet is just a different kind of busy. And when a multi-car pileup suddenly floods the trauma bays, they don't start from scratch. They just pivot. That's the destroyer. The quiet isn't quiet. It's preparation with a different soundtrack.
Let's rewind a few months to understand how we got here. April 2026, the joint U.S.-Israel operation. Major coordinated strikes, target deconfliction, intelligence sharing, the whole thing. Then May through June, multiple rounds of negotiations. Three distinct rounds, each one raising and then dashing hopes of de-escalation. And then the breakdown. And now this new CENTCOM strike campaign that started July 11th and has run three consecutive nights as of today, July 14th.
Underneath all of that is a force that has been in continuous high readiness posture since 2023. That's the part that doesn't make headlines. The U.S. has maintained a carrier presence in the region without interruption for over 3 years now. Some sailors are on their second or third deployment extension. The operational rhythm that keeps that force functional, that's the invisible structure Daniel's question is really about. I want to pause on that 3-year number for a second because it's easy to hear it and move on. 3 years of continuous carrier presence in one region is historically unusual. During the height of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, carrier deployments rotated with gaps. The Navy deliberately built in breathers. What we're seeing now is a sustained surge that was originally designed for short-term crises, and it's been stretched to 3 years.
That's a good flag. So how does the Navy even make that sustainable? What does that actually look like on the deck plates? Let's start with the mechanics of the three different modes these forces operate in.
And the research lays this out clearly. There are essentially three distinct operational modes in this conflict. Mode 1, high-tempo strike operations like what's happening right now under CENTCOM. Mode 2, negotiation/pause mode, which we saw through May and June. Mode 3, crisis standby, the period before the joint operation with Israel in April. Each mode has a different watch schedule, different rules of engagement, and completely different psychological demands on the crew. And here's the thing. The transitions between these modes aren't neatly scheduled. There's no countdown clock. The shift can happen mid-watch, and the crew just has to absorb it.
Let's start with the negotiation period, because that's the one Daniel was most curious about. The diplomats are talking. The president is signaling openness to a deal. What is a destroyer crew actually doing? Because I think the civilian assumption is, negotiations means stand down. Ships return to port. Everyone gets some R&R.
That assumption couldn't be further from reality, and it's worth unpacking why. So picture an Arleigh Burke-class destroyer, about 300 personnel. It's deployed near the Strait of Hormuz, which by the way sees roughly 20% of the world's oil transit every single day. This is not a quiet backwater. Even during negotiations, the ship is running a three-section watch rotation. That means the crew is divided into three groups, and at any given moment, one-third of the ship is on watch, one-third is sleeping, and one-third is doing maintenance, training, or personal time. Three-section rotation sounds manageable on paper, but let's be concrete about what that means for an individual sailor. You stand 8 hours of watch. Then you have 8 hours theoretically off, except that off time includes eating, showering, laundry, any training you need to complete, any qualification you're working toward, and then sleep. If your watch ends at 0700 and you need to be asleep by 1300 to get enough rest before your next watch at 2000, that doesn't leave much room for anything else.
Nobody's cracking open a keg. Daniel guessed that correctly.
The captain is absolutely not cracking a beer. Here's what a typical day actually looks like during the negotiation period. 0600 quarters. That's the morning muster where the division officer takes accountability and passes down the plan of the day. 0700 engineering rounds. The gas turbine engines that drive the ship need constant monitoring, negotiation, or no negotiation. These are LM2500 turbines, the same basic engine that powers commercial airliners, but adapted for marine use. They're incredibly reliable, but they're also incredibly thirsty, and they demand constant attention. A single turbine generating 25,000 horsepower, and the ship has four of them. Lose one to a maintenance failure during a lull, and you've degraded your combat capability before a single shot is fired.
The engineering department never gets a light day.
0800 combat systems drills. The Aegis radar stays on 24/7. The crew runs simulated engagement drills because if an Iranian fast attack craft makes a run at a tanker, the response time is measured in seconds, not minutes. Let me give you a concrete example of why this matters. In 2021, an Iranian fast attack craft closed to within 68 yards of a U.S. patrol vessel in the Persian Gulf. 68 yards. That's closer than the length of a soccer field. The entire encounter, from initial detection to closest approach, took under 4 minutes. If the watch team isn't drilling that scenario regularly, they don't have the muscle memory to respond appropriately. And appropriately, in that context, means escalating through the right sequence of warnings, maneuvers, and if necessary, defensive fire, all while someone is simultaneously on the radio trying to de-escalate. That's a lot of cognitive load for a 22-year-old operations specialist.
The E-2 Hawkeye is still flying?
Every single day. The E-2 Hawkeye airborne early warning aircraft can stay airborne for over 6 hours on a single sortie. During negotiations, those sorties don't stop. The difference is the posture. During strike operations, the Hawkeye is directing fighters onto targets. During negotiations, it's building the recognized maritime picture, tracking every vessel in the area, monitoring Iranian air defense radar emissions, looking for patterns. The intelligence preparation never pauses, and this is one of those invisible costs I mentioned. Every E-2 flight hour burns fuel, wears out engines, and adds to the maintenance backlog. Those aircraft have a finite service life measured in flight hours. Every hour spent on surveillance during negotiations is an hour you can't get back for combat operations later.
The sensors stay hot, but the weapons stay cold. What's the term for that?
Weapons tight versus weapons free. Weapons tight means you can only engage if you've been positively identified as hostile and you have explicit authorization. Weapons free means you can engage anything that meets predetermined hostile criteria. During negotiations, the posture is weapons tight, but the combat information center is still manned 24/7 because the pause could end with a missile launch at any moment. And that's not theoretical. The Iranians have fast attack craft. They have shore-based anti-ship missiles, and they've demonstrated willingness to use them. In 2016, Houthi forces in Yemen, backed by Iran, fired anti-ship missiles at U.S. Navy vessels. Multiple missiles, multiple times, over several days. The crews on those ships went from a routine patrol to incoming fire in seconds.
Walk me through the rest of that day. You got through the morning drills.
1000, replenishment at sea. A supply ship pulls alongside, and they transfer fuel, food, ordnance, mail. This is a massive coordination effort that happens regardless of the diplomatic situation. The ship needs to stay topped off because you never know when you'll need to sprint. and replenishment at sea is one of the most dangerous routine evolutions in naval operations. You've got two massive ships sailing parallel at close distance, connected by fuel hoses and transfer lines, and if something goes wrong, you've got a casualty situation on your hands. 1200, meal. 1300, maintenance on the 5-inch gun or the close-in weapon system or the torpedo tubes. Every weapon system has a preventive maintenance schedule that doesn't care about negotiations. The Phalanx close-in weapon system, for example, the Gatling gun that defends the ship against incoming missiles, has a maintenance cycle that includes regular test firings. You can't skip those. If you skip them, the system might not work when you need it, and the need can arise with zero warning.
This is during the quiet period.
1500, intelligence brief on Iranian fast attack craft movements. The IRGC Navy operates differently from the regular Iranian Navy. They're more aggressive, less predictable, and they've been known to swarm U.S. ships with dozens of small boats. The regular Iranian Navy is a conventional force. They follow professional military norms, they communicate on standard maritime frequencies, they're predictable in ways that make them manageable. The IRGC Navy is a revolutionary guard force with a different chain of command, different doctrine, and a history of asymmetric tactics. During negotiations, the intelligence team is tracking both, but the IRGC Navy is the one that keeps watch officers up at night.
The day still isn't over.
1700, watch turnover. The oncoming section gets briefed on everything that happened during the day. Contacts of interest, engineering status, any intelligence updates. 1800, personal time. Email, workout, maybe a movie in the mess. But here's the thing about personal time on deployment, it's never fully off. You're still on the ship. If general quarters sounds, your movie stops and you're running to your station. The psychological weight of that constant readiness is subtle but cumulative. 2000, general quarters drill, simulated inbound missile. The entire crew goes to battle stations. They run this drill regularly because the threat is real and the response needs to be muscle memory. 2200, secure communications check with CENTCOM, confirming they can reach the chain of command if something happens. And then midnight to 0600, the three watch sections rotate through, keeping the ship running while most of the crew sleeps.
Even the boring day is packed. What about the other side of the coin, when the negotiations collapse and the strike order comes down? How fast does that shift actually happen?
Hours, not days. And this is where the operational planning infrastructure really shows its sophistication. The strike planning cells at CENTCOM and on the carrier don't start from scratch when the president orders strikes. They've been maintaining target packages the entire time. During negotiations, the target list is frozen. Nobody's adding new aim points. But the intelligence preparation continues. Satellite imagery analysis, signals intelligence collection, battle damage assessment from the April joint operation. The planning cell is in monitoring mode, but they're updating everything constantly. So when the order drops, they're not asking, what do we hit? They're asking which package is most current and appropriate for the political objective we've been given.
It's not figure out what to hit. It's activate package 3.
And the shift from monitoring to execution mode involves a cascade of decisions that ripples through every department on the ship. Rules of engagement change from weapons tight to weapons free for designated targets. The air wing on the carrier shifts its flight schedule. Strike aircraft that were in a maintenance rotation get pushed back into ready status. Ordnance gets loaded. The E-2 Hawkeye mission shifts from surveillance to strike direction. The destroyers move to their strike stations. And all of this happens while the ship's crew is still running the same watch rotation, still doing the same maintenance, still eating the same meals. The tempo just ratchets up. I want to give you a specific example of how this cascades. The ordnance loading process for a strike mission isn't something you do in 10 minutes. A single Tomahawk missile weighs over 3,000 pounds and requires a dedicated handling team. You're moving live ordnance on a rolling ship, often at night, often under operational security conditions where external communications are limited. The safety protocols don't change just because the political situation accelerated. So the ordnance teams are working under time pressure, in the dark with explosives, while the ship is potentially maneuvering. That's the reality of the shift from pause to strike.
That's the what. Now let's talk about the cost. To the people, the planning, and the strategy itself. Because Daniel's question gets at something deeper. What does this whiplash do to the humans inside the machine?
This is where the clinical side of my brain kicks in. The on-off, on-off pattern is actually more psychologically demanding than sustained high tempo. When you're in a continuous combat operation, you adapt. Your baseline resets. You know what to expect. But when you cycle between alert, relax, alert, relax, each cycle forces a psychological recalibration, and the unpredictability of the switch is the real driver of burnout. There's a concept in stress physiology called allostatic load, the cumulative wear and tear on the body from repeated cycles of stress activation and recovery. Each time you ramp up, your body mobilizes resources. Each time you ramp down, it tries to recover. But if the cycles are frequent and unpredictable, the recovery never fully completes. You're starting each new stress cycle from a slightly depleted baseline. Over months and years, that compounds.
It's not just that it's stressful. It's that the pattern of stress is specifically designed, unintentionally, to prevent recovery.
And there's data on this from the last time we danced with Iran, during the 2019 to 2020 U.S.-Iran tensions, the Soleimani strike and the aftermath. The Navy reported a measurable spike in mental health evacuations and early separations among junior enlisted personnel. The pattern was the same, periods of high alert punctuated by diplomatic pauses sustained over months. The human brain can handle sustained stress better than unpredictable stress. The unpredictability triggers a constant low-level cortisol response that never fully shuts off. And we're not just talking about feeling anxious. Chronic cortisol elevation affects sleep quality, immune function, decision-making, emotional regulation. On a warship, where every watch stander needs to make good decisions, that's a readiness issue, not just a wellness issue.
That was a shorter period than what we're seeing now. The continuous carrier presence since 2023 means some sailors have been living this cycle for over 3 years.
With deployment extensions. That's the other piece. When you extend a deployment, you're not just adding days at sea. You're telling a sailor that the leave they planned, the wedding they were supposed to attend, the birth of their child, that's all on hold, and they don't know for how long. The research shows 3 distinct negotiation rounds in May and June alone. Each round raised hopes, each breakdown crushed them. Multiply that across an entire crew, and you get what the operational stress literature calls decision fatigue, the degradation of judgment that comes from making constant high-stakes choices without a clear endpoint. Let me make this concrete. Imagine you're a junior officer standing watch in the Combat Information Center. For 3 weeks, you've been in negotiation posture, weapons tight, monitoring, tracking. You've internalized that the mission is de-escalation. Then, in the space of a watch turnover, the posture shifts to strike. You're now expected to make engagement decisions under weapons-free rules. The cognitive frame you've been operating in for weeks is suddenly obsolete. And you have to make that switch without missing a beat. Do that 2 or 3 times over the course of a deployment, and the mental whiplash is real.
There's a term in the research that stuck with me, readiness creep. The phenomenon where sustained high readiness without action erodes sharpness. You're always at battle stations, but you're never actually in battle. The edge dulls.
That's the paradox. The military builds redundancy into everything. Multiple contingency plans, 60 to 90 days of ordnance on hand, rotating carrier strike groups to avoid exhaustion. But the human element has a shelf life that logistics can't extend. You can stockpile tomahawks. You can't stockpile attention spans. I'm reminded of a study the Army did years ago on sentry duty. They found that after about 20 minutes of sustained attention on a static scene, the ability to detect subtle changes drops dramatically. Now apply that to a radar operator who's been staring at a screen for 3 hours on the 3rd consecutive night of strike operations during a deployment that's already been extended twice. The technology is only as good as the human at the console.
Let's talk about the planning side of this. How do you build target packages when the political objective keeps shifting? Because the planners at CENTCOM aren't just picking targets. They're building a campaign that's supposed to achieve a strategic effect. If the strategy changes every few weeks, how does that work?
This is where the volatile decision-maker angle from Daniel's prompt really bites. The U.S. military is designed to execute orders, not question them. But operational planners at CENTCOM need to forecast resource requirements months in advance. Fuel, ordnance, crew rest, maintenance cycles, port visit schedules. When the commander-in-chief can shift from negotiation to strike posture in a single morning, and we've seen that happen, the planning assumptions have to be incredibly conservative. You can't plan on the assumption that negotiations will hold, because if they don't, you're caught flat-footed. So you plan for the worst case and maintain the resources to execute it. But that means you're burning through readiness at a rate that assumes combat operations are imminent, even when they're not.
They plan for the worst case and hope for the best.
They maintain what's called strategic patience in the planning process. Multiple contingency plans for multiple scenarios. The surge capability of the reserves and National Guard is factored in. Carrier strike group rotations are scheduled with enough overlap that there's never a gap in coverage. But the cost of that conservatism is real. You're burning flight hours on aircraft that aren't striking targets. You're consuming fuel and food and spare parts at a combat tempo without the combat. And the maintenance debt accumulates. Every hour an FAK-1-18 flies a surveillance patrol during negotiations is an hour closer to its next depot-level maintenance cycle. Those cycles are scheduled years in advance. If you accelerate the flight hours, you pull maintenance forward, which creates gaps in future readiness that have to be filled somehow.
The Iranian side of this equation matters too. The three consecutive nights of strikes as of today, each night reduces their air defense and missile capability. But it also hardens their negotiating position.
That's the escalatory spiral in action. The operational tempo becomes a strategic signal. The U.S. is demonstrating that it can sustain strikes indefinitely. Iran is testing whether U.S. political will holds. And the people caught in the middle, the sailors on that destroyer, the aircrew on the carrier, they're executing a strategy that shifts under their feet. The joint operation with Israel in April required months of coordination. Target deconfliction, intelligence sharing, refueling schedules. That level of trust with an ally takes time to build and can erode quickly when the political environment shifts rapidly. And here's a concrete example of what that erosion looks like. During the April joint operation, the U.S. and Israel used a shared target deconfliction process that had been developed over years of joint exercises. If the U.S. political posture shifts unpredictably, the Israelis have to ask, will the Americans still be operating under the same rules of engagement next month? Can we share intelligence without it being used in ways we didn't anticipate? Those questions don't have obvious answers when the commander-in-chief's position can change overnight.
Israel needs predictable U.S. support. They're planning their own operations around assumptions about what the U.S. will and won't do. When those assumptions change week to week, the alliance strain is real.
The research bears this out. The April operation was a high-water mark of coordination. Since then, the on-again, off-again pattern has made joint planning harder. Not impossible. The military-to-military relationships are strong enough to absorb some turbulence, but harder. And harder means slower. Slower means less responsive. In a region where the threat environment can shift in hours, that lag matters. It's not a broken alliance, but it's an alliance operating with friction that didn't exist 6 months ago.
Where does that leave us? Three things to take away from this look inside the tempo.
First, the U.S. military's ability to sustain this whiplash tempo is genuinely a strategic asset. The force can shift from diplomatic posture to strike posture in hours. That flexibility keeps Iran off balance and unable to predict U.S. moves. But it has a shelf life. The force has been in continuous high readiness posture since 2023. It's resilient, but not infinitely so. The boring periods, the negotiations, the lulls, that's when the real work of maintenance training and intelligence preparation happens. The strikes are just the visible tip of a very deep iceberg, and the iceberg is showing signs of strain. Not cracks yet, but the maintenance backlogs are growing. The deployment extensions are accumulating. The human cost is rising. None of this is catastrophic today, but it's a trajectory, not a steady state.
Second, the unpredictability of the decision-making cycle is itself a form of strategy. It creates uncertainty for the adversary, but it also creates risks that don't make headlines. Miscalculation. What if Iran misreads a drill as an attack? We've seen that movie before. In 2019, Iran shot down a U.S. surveillance drone, and the U.S. came within minutes of retaliatory strikes before the order was called off. In an environment where the U.S. posture shifts without warning, the odds of someone misreading a signal go up. Then there's fratricide from rush targeting. When the planning cycle compresses, the margin for error shrinks. And the erosion of allied trust, especially with Israel, who needs to know whether the U.S. will be there tomorrow in the same way it was there yesterday.
Third, the actionable takeaway for anyone following this conflict. When you read headlines about strikes or negotiations, ask yourself what phase of the operational tempo we're in. Is this a sustained campaign, a punitive strike, or a diplomatic signal? The answer changes everything about what the troops on the ground are experiencing. A three-night strike campaign with a fourth night possible is a very different psychological reality than a one-and-done retaliatory strike. The operational tempo tells you more about the strategy than the headlines ever will. And if you want to know whether the U.S. is escalating or de-escalating, don't listen to the speeches. Look at the watch rotations. Look at the rules of engagement. Look at the flight schedules. That's where the real strategy lives.
Which brings us back to that destroyer in the Gulf of Oman, and the question nobody can answer yet. Tonight, the crew might get a full night's sleep, or they might get the call for a fourth night of strikes. The uncertainty is the only certainty. And as the US and Iran continue this dance, the question that matters most is, what happens when the force that's been dancing for 3 years finally needs a break? The answer will determine the next phase of this conflict. Not the next round of negotiations, not the next strike package, the next phase, the one where the human and material costs of this tempo come due.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1960s, Soviet archaeologists excavating in Turkmenistan claimed to have found inscriptions in an unknown logographic script they called Central Asian Linear A, which they theorized was a missing link between Mesopotamian cuneiform and the Indus Valley script. The claim stood for nearly a decade before a linguist at Leningrad University demonstrated that the inscriptions were actually decorative grooves from a potter's wheel. The clay vessels had been misidentified as writing tablets. The correction was quietly published in a Soviet archaeology journal in 1971, and almost nobody in the West noticed. The original misidentification had already made its way into Western textbooks, where it persisted for years. So somewhere out there, there may still be reference works listing a writing system that was actually just a potter having a busy afternoon.
A potter's wheel. There's probably a metaphor in there about seeing patterns that aren't actually there, but I'm too tired to find it. This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to understand the hidden rhythms of the world, subscribe wherever you get podcasts. We'll be back next week with another prompt you didn't know you needed.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.